Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Okay, welcome sharkies back to Sharkpedia. Today we have Dr. Catherine McDonald. Dr. McDonald, thank you so much for being here today.
Of course, thrilled to be here.
We're so excited to have you. We, Imani and I actually know you a bit because you have been an excellent mentor to us already in our early careers, and you actually just received a 2021 Mentor of the Year Award. Is that correct?
I did.
Round of applause. We had to say something about it because you're an awesome mentor for both of us. And you've definitely like shaped my early career science path. And we just wanted everyone listening to know that you're awesome.
Thank you very much. Those of you who cannot see us, I'm now red.
Yeah. You are, but it's true, and I just, you've been such an incredible mentor, and if you aren't already following her, you should follow her, especially on Twitter, at Dr_CatMac. She's an incredible, inspiring scientist, and is a great person to get to know, especially if you want to get into the shark field. But not only is Dr. McDonald an incredible mentor, she is the director of the Field School, which we'll ask about in just a moment, and she is also a lecturer at University of Miami, as well as an MPS Marine Conservation Track Coordinator. So welcome again, Dr. McDonald.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, before we get into it, can you just describe what the Field School is? If you follow any of us on Twitter, you've definitely seen us retweet these things, but let's break it down for our listeners that aren't on Twitter or don't already know.
So Field School is a marine science education and training organization that I co-founded with some of my friends in 2015 because we saw a real problem with the delivery of especially field education in marine science. A lot of PIs don't have much time, interest, desire to teach field skills. Some PIs don't have a lot of field skills. And often I found that undergrads, master students, even PhD students found themselves having to try to reinvent the wheel in terms of the best practices for marine field work. And so our goal was to create a space where people could come and learn those skills from people who have a lot of experience applying them in an environment that was safe, supportive, welcoming, and where people would feel like they belonged in marine science.
If that doesn't explain right there why she's such an incredible mentor, I don't know what does, but that's so incredible. And it is super, super hard to get hands-on skills. I think in any science application, if you can't get your foot in the door, and it's also expensive, right, to get your foot, to actually get that hands-on experience, especially with something like sharks, because you need likely a boat and a crew and all the things that go with that to actually be able to get up-close experience.
Well, and I know I have a lot of students who do internships and often they really love them. They get a lot out of them in terms of, you know, travel and experiencing other cultures. And, you know, a lot of times they're really happy with the experience. But in marine science, there are a lot of pay-to-play internships where you spend money to go be part of an internship and you wind up sweeping a lot of floors, washing a lot of dishes. And on the one hand, I'm really sympathetic to organizations who are strapped for cash and who rely on that as a way to keep their doors open. A lot of them are doing important conservation work that I feel invested in. And on the other hand, it feels exploitive of students. You know, we're all trapped in a system that has some really big fundamental problems. So I tend not to want to be really aggressive in blaming either students for going after these opportunities or organizations that offer them for trying to keep the doors open, give kids a chance to get hands-on with sharks. But at the end of the day, it's a system that's built on exploitation of students to do science. And fundamentally, I think that demands better from us. And we would be better off with a social effort to reinvest in science, and especially in science students, in a way that we have not in recent decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the other things that that causes when you have to pay for an internship like that is that it makes it very exclusive. So you tend to get very privileged people that have the funds to do so, and other people that don't necessarily have money don't get the experience that it takes to get in this field, which is so unfortunate because there's so many bright minds out there that would just benefit us by having them in the field, but they just can't get the experience because it's so cost prohibitive.
One of the founding principles of Field School was that we have at least one scholarship student on every single course we run. We earmark that bunk for a student who can't otherwise afford to be there. And my hope is that 10 years from now, I'll know a bunch of awesome scientists who got their start there. But, we can all do our part to make these kinds of opportunities more accessible and to, put our literal and metaphorical money where our mouths are.
Absolutely. So to do the field school, how would a student be able to learn more about the field school or do an opportunity through your program?
They can follow us on Instagram, is probably the social media site we're most active on, field_school. We post all of our scholarship opportunities there when they open up. And our website, getintothefield.com, is a pretty good resource if you want to know more about us and what we do and what courses we offer.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I guess we'll go ahead and start getting into the paper that we're going to break down with you today, which Dr. McDonald is the primary author of. Amani, do you want to go ahead and break down that summary for us?
Yes. The paper that we are going to be discussing today is Conservation Potential of Apex Predator Tourism. So a summary of this paper is, the paper uses case studies to explore the intersections of predator tourism and the conservation challenges associated with it for three species of animals, sharks, crocodiles, and big cats. Wildlife tourism is multifaceted. On one hand, some believe it can have positive effects, such as creating more of an appreciation and will to conserve wildlife. On the other hand, wildlife tourism may potentially have negative effects on wildlife, such as changing their behavior or affecting their health. Shark tourism is a valuable industry in many countries. In this paper, the Shark Reef Marine Reserve Project in Fiji was examined. This paper found that apex predator tourism is more likely to succeed when it has public and political support and when its regulations are maintained, monitored, and enforced. So before we dive into this paper, I think we should define some terms, because there are a lot of terms in this paper that if you are not an animal scientist, and especially not a scientist in general, you don't know what they mean. So I wanted to start out with asking you, Dr. McDonald, what's the difference between ecotourism and wildlife tourism?
So this is a really complicated question because it depends a lot on who you ask. So at least in theory, in broad strokes, ecotourism is tourism that is socially, biologically, environmentally sustainable, right? It involves educating tourists. It involves benefits to local communities. It involves, you know, ecological sustainability for the ecosystems or wildlife that are being viewed. But in practice, there's no barrier to presenting yourself as an ecotour, whatever your practices are. And in fact, a study that I did as part of my PhD dissertation found that when you surveyed the general public about what ecotourism meant, they didn't assume that it had all of those characteristics that I just listed, that any, you know, basic academic definition of the term would probably include. So even as academics debate a lot, you know, is it ecotourism? Is it not? Can ecotourism achieve conservation outcomes? You know, and then you'll have some folks saying, well, if they're not achieving those outcomes, then it's not really ecotourism, right? So on some level, ecotourism can't fail. If it fails, it's just tourism. And on the other side, you have people saying these terms are being used so broadly, so imprecisely. They're being used to greenwash environmentally harmful businesses so aggressively that it's not really a term that means a lot anymore. And I have sympathy for both sides of that conversation, but I think that fundamentally my thought about it is that whatever the difference from an academic perspective, there isn't a ton of difference from a practical real world perspective.
Do you mind touching base briefly on what it means to have harmful wildlife practices for tourism?
Yeah, so I actually make my class do this little exercise, right, where I say, all right, great news, guys. We're all going to Crystal River here in Florida. We're going to swim with manatees. We're all really excited. Hooray. You guys have been in my class for half a semester. What do you think we would do to maximize the well-being of those manatees? And a lot of hands go up and they're like, well, we wouldn't get too close to them. There would be a limit on the number of people in the water. There would be a limit on the number of boats. There would be areas that are zoned for no swimmers so that the manatees can move away from us if they want to. Maybe we'd only be in the water at particular times of year. We wouldn't be touching them. We wouldn't be approaching manatees with calves. You get this long, very thoughtful list. And then you say, okay, guys, we're going swimming with manatees. What do you want out of it? And they're like, great pictures. I want to get up close to the manatee. I want to feel like I connected with it on a spiritual level. I want to squeeze the little manatee baby. I want to feed it lettuce and have it love me forever. I want to ride it.
I'm trying not to laugh.
But like,
it's so true though.
It's true. I mean, and like, I'm not holding myself up as an exemplar here. Like, I want to do that. That sounds awesome.
100%. I 100% like did everything I could to get a photo of me with a sea turtle in it when I was studying abroad one time. Like, absolutely. Yep. Everyone wants that opportunity.
We are all guilty of this.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, they go through this exercise and then I'm like, do you see a problem here? Because we have these competing incentives, right? If you're a tourism business, you care about sustainability, right? Because you need those manatees to be there into the future if your business is going to last. But you also care about tourist satisfaction because that's what drives business to you. And especially with things like TripAdvisor these days, if people aren't satisfied, you're going to hear about it. And so I think that it's really natural. It makes perfect sense that plenty of operators would want to cut corners on that stuff, would say, well, you know, one person touching the manatee, like it's not the end of the world. But if you multiply that across all the operators, across all the tourists, across all the days that those operators are on the water, you start to see how something like that could have a meaningful effect on animal well-being.
Yeah. Absolutely. That makes total sense. Let's also define for our listeners really quick. Can you define what conservation is? Maybe specifically with shark conservation. What does shark conservation really mean?
So nobody likes scientists. We're very unpopular. And one of the reasons for that is that we can't agree on almost anything. And so you can find plenty of debate about what conservation means, right? And in this country, we have this historic duality between conservation and preservation, where preservation is intended to preserve environments in their like untouched natural state. There's a whole separate host of problems with that idea that we won't dive into right now. And conservation is designed to manage wildlife or natural resources of various kinds for maximum human benefit while maintaining them in a healthy and sustainable way. So preservation would be, this is a national park now, nobody can ever touch it. Conservation would be, this is a state forest. We allow limited logging on a schedule that we believe doesn't affect overall forest ecosystem health.
Got it. Yeah, okay, that makes perfect sense. And so in this paper, it talks a lot about marine reserves. So let's just talk about what marine reserves are and how those can be so different, especially depending on where you are in the world or even depending on where you go on the same reef, a reserve might be very different. So what is a marine reserve and what are the varying parts of those marine reserves?
In the most basic terms, a marine reserve is typically an area of ocean that is in some way regulated differently from the areas around it and is provided with some kinds of additional protection. But there's a huge amount of variability in that additional protection, in the sense that you can be talking about, you know, no take marine reserves in which you're not allowed to touch anything, even no entry marine reserves in which, you know, I can't go snorkeling, scientists can't conduct research, they're closed to humans entirely. That's kind of the far end of the spectrum in terms of minimizing human impacts on an environment. And on the other side, you can have occasional closures, you can have gear restrictions, you can have different bag limits, right? You're allowed to catch a smaller number of fish within the reserve than you would be outside of the reserve. You can have different rules about what species can and can't be taken. You can have changed size limits for how large or small a fish has to be in order for it to be of legal size. And as you can imagine, as you advance the complexity of these regulations, they get harder and harder for people to comply with in terms of knowing what you're allowed to do and where and to what extent. But they also allow you more and more precision in your efforts to meet your management goals. So as managers on some level, you know, if our goal is conservation, we want to allow for the extraction of the maximum sustainable yield from that site, right? We want people to take as much as they can without compromising future availability. But we also have only these like fairly blunt tools with which to shape the rules here, because the more precise tools, as you start to use them, compliance gets harder and harder. And then, of course, we can't talk about marine reserves without talking about the difficulties of enforcing rules out on the ocean, and the reality that there are plenty of marine reserves globally that are protected on paper, but in practice, the rules are not functionally very different from the waters around them.
Right. I mean, and one of the biggest reasons just being that who's going to be there? Who are you paying to sit there and just monitor it the whole time?
I mean, and this all gets further complicated, I would say, by the reality that in a lot of cases, marine reserves are most likely to be implemented in areas where the people who will be negatively affected by them have the least political power. And so, you know, I try to teach my students conservation that doesn't work for people doesn't work. But we do see a tendency to place marine reserves either in places that are so remote that maybe they're not that useful because there's not a lot of human activity taking place there anyway, or in places where we're willing to deny communities access to resources that they have historically had access to and maybe even been reliant on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that people don't always realize is that if you want laws and protection against a certain species, you have to include something called stakeholders, which are the people that have a stake in the game, right? They either want the fish, their livelihood is dependent on being able to fish those species, or another stakeholder might be the consumer, people like that. And you have to consider all of the stakeholders at the table before you put things in place. And one of the biggest mistakes that scientists see over and over again that we're not perfect at and trying to be better at is including all those stakeholders, including fishers, right? Fishers can be oftentimes difficult to get that seat at the table, and their voice is often not heard, which is, you know, it's not surprising that sometimes there can be conflict between fishers and scientists because we just don't always include them. So I don't honestly blame them all the time for being frustrated for not having a voice with something that directly affects their entire livelihood.
I mean, and I think part of it too is trying to make sure that people who care about these issues understand that there are real costs. So, you know, I think it's really common, especially here in the United States, to hear discourse around, you know, how barbaric and monstrous shark finning is and how nobody should be allowed to do that. And on some level, I think that, you know, if you reframe that in terms of people needing to meet essential needs and feed their families, and in a lot of cases, shark fins that are on global markets are coming from sharks that are being captured, killed, eaten, and the fins are an additional foreign currency earner. you know, I think you can say we're concerned about the sustainability of global shark fisheries without saying that people who rely on sharks for their livelihoods are evil by nature.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really easy for us in the privileged lives that we live where we can say, oh, I'm not going to eat fish because I can go to the grocery store and get vegan products. I can eat just chicken. It's easy for us to just say, well, why can't other people do that? Why can't they just not eat fish? Why can't they just not eat shark? And we have to make sure that we're always considering the fact that we are very lucky to be able to have that stance and other people are not. And that does not make them the villain in a situation. And someone's culture does not make them the villain in a situation just because we disagree with it.
One way I think about this is that fundamentally science is about service, right? You're working in service of the communities that rely on those resources. You're working in service of the people who care about those animals. And your goal should always be to provide them with the best, most thoughtful information that you can. And I think that it's not as uncommon as I would wish for scientists to think that their scientific expertise means that they should tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. In the same way that I think it's not that uncommon for advocates to feel like their care for sharks means that they should get to tell people what to do.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, like if we actually see everyone as people, it makes sense that the thing we have to do is have difficult conversations about what we want to prioritize and how.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the really interesting things about this paper in particular was that in this marine reserve, a single dive operator had access to get into this marine reserve, which I don't know if that's common. I have never heard of that, a dive shop operation being able to get access to a restricted marine reserve. And then if you're a visitor, you could go with them into this marine reserve. You could get basically exclusive access, and one of their biggest money makers was doing a shark feed dive. So that was really one of the things that they were looking at and evaluated kind of the cost and benefits of that. So can you kind of talk a little bit about that? What are the positive and negatives that could come from something like that, especially in this case in a marine reserve?
So one of the things that makes that, you know, possible in Fiji is a cultural tradition of reef ownership. Right. So it's possible to ask as a tourism operator to have exclusive access to a reef, and there are the right people who you should compensate for that access and for that reef protection. Whereas in the US and in many other places around the world, typically marine resources are seen as open access. They belong equally to everyone. We're all entitled to them. Although, of course, we also do privilege some particular kinds of historic use. Here and in other places. And so a lot of times when you have stakeholder conflicts around tourism, it's a tourism operator saying, well, I want to exclude fishermen from this site because, you know, I'm generating more revenue through my shark dive than they would generate by catching these sharks. But if they catch these sharks, my shark dive can't continue. But it's really rare for there to be some mechanism for distributing the benefits of that tourism in ways that reach the people who are bearing the costs. So obviously habituation to boats, right? Getting comfortable with approaching boats, being used to taking dead fish that's being offered to them, poses some real risks to sharks. And some shark tourism sites have had some pretty high profile tragic incidents where, you know, fishermen pull up to the dive site at night, throw a bunch of hooks in the water, and, you know, can pretty much clean out a dive site of sharks that are accustomed to coming to the sound of a boat engine and taking fish that's being thrown overboard. There's this really strong thread in the discourse about this stuff that says, you know, sharks are worth more alive for tourism than dead, and that's going to conserve sharks. And the thing that I think we need to remember is that you want to think not just about total economic production, but about who benefits and how. And in most cases in tourism, it can be really difficult to distribute those benefits in an equitable way to communities. Particularly because it's quite common for wildlife tourism operations, including shark tourism operations around the world, to be owned by expats from North America and Europe, even when they occur in other places. And so in a lot of cases, an outsized portion of those economic benefits are actually captured by people who, you know, maybe live there now, but are not traditionally part of that community. And so we need to think about what makes tourism attractive to communities, and recognize that tourism that isn't attractive to communities shouldn't be taking place. And I think we're just starting to have some of those really difficult conversations, you know, particularly in the US, in Hawaii, but around the world.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you said that I think is really important to reiterate is the importance of considering the people who live where you're going to have the tourism site, for example, or even in research, going somewhere and doing research and making sure that you are including the people who have lived there longer than you have, even if you don't live there, who have been there, understand the environment, probably have ways that they go about doing things, and really interacting with them and engaging with them and including them in your research, rather than going and saying, well, I'm here now, this is what I'm doing. Because we definitely have a tendency as people to just apply ourselves in other situations and then not consider the effects that our actions then have on another community. So can you talk a little bit about your research in St. Vincent, something that I really enjoy listening to you talk about? Will you discuss, you know, how you went about engaging with local communities and what that has looked like in terms of your project and also for you?
Yeah, I mean, I personally, and there are probably scientists who could do this with more comfort because either they're less sensitive to these issues or they're more outgoing and gregarious than I am. But, you know, I'm a little bit of a shy egghead. I wouldn't enter a community that I'm not part of to try to do science without an invitation from a member of that community. And I would recommend that most scientists probably shouldn't be doing that either. And I think that we should think about it like any other human relationship, right? The people that you know there, if they're not becoming your friends, if they're not, you know, people who you care about, if you're not reciprocally doing things for them to thank them for the things that they're doing for you, then I'm not totally sure what you're doing, but it's not joining a community. It's not trying to contribute on terms of equality. So we have particular skills and training that mean that we have something to offer to people in many cases. But I think that we don't always recognize all that they have to offer to us. And it's a good idea to keep that in mind.
Yeah, it absolutely is. They also, when you talk to people in those communities, they know so much more about oftentimes the species you want to study. Like a lot of times I've seen actually a paper that was recently published about a shark species where the government put a policy on to help increase the shark population. But the fishers were like, well, they're not even here during that time. And if they had just included the local fishers, they would have actually protected the sharks. So it's like, you know, you got to engage the community. It benefits you. It benefits them. You have to work together.
I mean, and I think some part of it is also a problem with the way that scientists are taught to think about this stuff and rewarded for their work. Because on some level, you know, I read a paper a while ago based in the US, right, that did an angler survey and said, hey, we did this angler survey. And what we found was that what the anglers know from experience aligns with what we've proved using science, right? And then in their conclusion, they're like, so we need more outreach to anglers.
Doesn't sound like it.
And I was like, do you? Is that what your data tells you?
It sounds like you need to listen to fishers more.
Exactly. But we, you know, in writing grants, in pitching our work, we're rewarded much more for saying we're going to teach benighted fishermen how to do the right thing than we are for saying we're going to go into those communities respectfully and try to learn from what they know.
Yeah. The fishers in San Francisco have been hugely beneficial to me with studying seven gill sharks because they'll call me. I put external tags on them that have my phone number and they call me, and they're usually the most concerned about this species of shark. They're the first ones to say, what's going on with them? I'm not seeing as many. How can I help? And like, that is just so incredible. And that's why we need to include all the stakeholders and include the people that are most impacted by it, because they care usually the most.
Yeah. And just to kind of build on that, like, remember everyone who's listening that, like, when we say stakeholder, what we mean is people who have a stake in what happens. And so that includes fishers. It includes environmentalists who love seven gills, myself included. It includes scientists who care about outcomes for sharks. It includes managers. There's a long list of people who are stakeholders, but, you know, we tend to kind of frame this question in a really adversarial way a lot of the time. And I've felt very fortunate to work with a lot of fishers and anglers, both commercial and recreational, who are curious and interested and engaged and honestly have more skin in the game in terms of the sustainability of fisheries resources than anybody else.
I'm going to redirect us a little bit to start thinking a little bit more about this study again in Fiji specifically. And one of the things that the paper kind of discussed is one of the reasons it was not as effective as they had hoped was because it's a rather small marine reserve. So let's talk about that for a minute. Why do small marine reserves, when do they work, and why don't they always work, especially in the case of something like a shark species?
I mean, it gets tricky when you're talking about big animals that often travel long distances operating within a small protected area. They're going to spend significant parts of their lives outside of it. That, you know, is a fundamental piece of my work more generally, because I do some work on some pretty highly migratory species like great hammerheads, scalloped hammerheads, sandbar sharks here in Miami, who cross, you know, state and sometimes international boundaries in their natural activities. And so it's a lot harder to manage an animal that makes those long range migrations than it is to manage an animal like a nurse shark, where we'll recapture it 3 years later, 1 mile from where we first caught it. And for those of you who are listening who are nurse shark experts, I'm not saying they don't ever move. I'm just saying it's a little bit easier to manage animals that tend to be more site attached and that have smaller home ranges too. There are a lot of species of teleost fish as well, bony fish that, you know, use multiple habitats either across an individual day or seasonally. Great, you've protected this piece of their essential habitat, but if it doesn't include other places that they need to go to spawn, to aggregate, to feed, then it's probably not adequate protection for that species.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is no invisible fence at the end of a marine protected area. There's not like a red light that says, hey, you can't leave. We're trying to protect you. Stay here. They're just going to come and go as they please. And like you said, with nurse sharks, if they're not actively migrating, then that's great for them. And the MPA probably works really well. But if you consider highly migratory species, the MPA may protect them for a day. But then when they leave that area the next day, they're no longer protected in the same way.
Well, and in a case like Fiji, where those animals are also being provisioned, right? They're being fed. Even if you're creating kind of an artificially high concentration of those animals in that reserve by having this attractive provisioning site from their perspective, there are a lot of species of shark that are not so social that they're going to want to be in close quarters with each other. So you're going to see some natural tendency to spread out other than at provisioning times. That's going to occur no matter what you do. And of course, those kinds of enhanced concentrations can lead to greater risks of injury from each other as they're competing for food, greater risks of disease and parasite spread as they come into physical contact with each other. So in addition to the range of other problems that you potentially introduce for wildlife when you start wildlife tourism operations up, there are also some possible health effects.
So when you say sharks are social, right, it's not like they're going to a bar having a beer together. Can you explain what that means and how that may vary across species for those of our listeners who don't know what it means when you say a shark is social?
Very happily. So there are some species of shark that tend not to spend a lot of time in company with what we in ecology would call their conspecifics, right? Other sharks of similar species size, age, and others that, you know, want to see how many white tip reef sharks we can fit in this cave. Let's stick them all in and we're up to 20. That's great. We're stacked like logs. They love it. That variability is, I think, to me at least, very charming about sharks. One of my favorite things about them is they've been around so long. You know, if you think of evolution as basically a tool for solving problems, they've had so much time that they've come up with so many different amazing ways to solve problems that you see this incredible diversity in reproductive style, in social preferences, in feeding preferences, in size, in behavior, in morphology, that make them never, ever boring.
So we kind of touched on this earlier with shark finning. And so one of the things that I want to talk about is shark mortality is very multifaceted, but shark finning is one of the things that people who aren't scientists see the most. And so one of the things I'd really like to touch on is what are the different things contributing to shark mortality that are not just this one problem that we see continuously in documentaries, in the media, in shows that get really big on TV or are in articles, right? There's commercial fishing, there's recreational fishing, all of these are contributing to it. And so I think we could take some time to talk about how much they contribute to things like shark mortality.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, students who ask me like, what can I do for sharks? Ocean problems are shark problems, right? So anything that you can do to help create a healthier, more vibrant ocean will benefit sharks at the end of the day. You know, I tell them, I don't care if you live in Indiana, convince your family not to apply fertilizer to your lawn, ask them, you know, to do a river cleanup with you. Everything flows downhill. All of that is headed to the ocean at the end of the day. And so the choices that we all make in our daily lives can make a difference. And I say that not to say, hey, we're responsible for doing that. Because another thing that I try to point out to my students is, you know, there's this kind of moral hierarchy, right? Like, I'm not, but I'm a vegan. I bike to school. I don't own a car. I don't use air conditioning. You know, you have a long list of like the things that you do to protect the earth that make you better than other people. And we want to think about those things both as a function of privilege. You know, can you afford the extra money that it costs to eat differently? Can you afford the extra time that it takes to bike to work? Is where you live a safe, reasonable place to bike? Is your job close enough that that's possible? Do you live somewhere that's served well by public transit? And, you know, on and on down the list. But also on some level, those debates are literally designed to make us turn on each other. Like that drawing of Spider-Man pointing at himself. That's a meme.
Look at you. You pointed out a meme.
See?
Catherine is the meme queen on Twitter, in my opinion.
Yes. I did not expect that praise from Imani.
I laugh at them all the time. Anyway, continue with your Spider-Man meme.
But, you know, the initial kind of push to get consumers to reduce their energy consumption as a solution to environmental problems was literally funded by big oil, right? The point of this is to say, if there are environmental problems, they're your fault, or they're the people around you's fault. They're not our giant company's fault. There's no way we could be responsible or that systemic change could be necessary. The thing that you guys have to do is stop being such selfish pricks. And on some level, I think that's kind of paralleling the shark discourse, right? Where I have so many students who come into school being like, the problem is China and people who eat shark fin soup, or the problem is, you know, fishers in the global south who catch sharks and sell their fins. And like, no, the problem is a system in which everyone doesn't have enough to eat and access to clean water and schooling. And the idea that somebody who has, you know, a standard of living far, far below your own is morally culpable for killing an animal that they may or may not know much about to feed their families is like fundamentally very unreasonable. But it's being presented to us in part as an alternative to like really revisiting the way that we think about these things, because that revisiting is not going to be all that great for people with a lot of money and power.
Yeah. Yeah. Something that I always feel the need to reiterate, and similar to what you just said, is that just because someone else's way of trying to help the planet, trying to help the ocean, doesn't look exactly like your way, does not mean that they care any less about it or that they aren't trying as hard as you are. And we have a tendency to say, well, I'm doing all these things, why aren't you? And like you said, maybe that person doesn't have the ability to be vegan. Maybe that person doesn't have the ability to not drive a car. And we really have to like bring ourselves back down to earth and say, well, why are we able to do this? And why might this person not be able to? And then address those issues at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, calories per dollar, McDonald's is a great deal. So is a lot of fast food. So is a lot of what we would call junk food. And it won't spoil. And, you know, it's easy. And so to say people who are earning $8 an hour and maybe have kids to feed should feel shame or guilt for accessing the most filling, low-cost food that gives them pleasure that they can is, again, just like fundamentally not something I feel very comfortable with.
Yeah. Yeah, if our listeners take anything away from this, I hope that it's that, and have a little bit more compassion for the people around you. We're all on the same team here. We're all on the same planet, and we have to figure out how to work together to accomplish these really, really big, big problems, because it's not just one solution, and it's not going to be one solution fits all. We have to be adaptable, and we have to be able to willing to seek change and incorporate lots of different groups of people to make that happen and stop pointing fingers at each other, because it's just not going to get us in the right place. It's not going to get us to the end goal that we all, I think, really want.
I mean, and I guess what I would add is, think about if you want to make a difference in what other people do, think about how you can make it easier for them to do the thing you want them to do, not about how to force them to do the thing that you're doing. Right? You can influence your city. Right here in Miami-Dade, we would benefit a lot from better public transit. Even if you're not going to use it, advocate for it. We would benefit a lot from improved sewer systems and less reliance on septic, because we have this very high water table. Thank you, sea level rise. Advocate for it. You know, people think that the way that they're going to make a difference is by, you know, going to shop for their beans in a glass jar. But everybody's not going to do that. Shouting at everybody that they should do that is not a solution. I mean, it's great if you can. I'm not trying to crap on glass jar bean people.
Angry.
But you know, the goal shouldn't be to make everybody do things that our system is not designed to do. The goal should be to design a system that makes it easy for us all to live in a way that the planet can sustain.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things with tourism too is that it's often pitched as this like non-consumptive option, right? So it's a way to make money from sharks that doesn't harm them. But A, we know that we should really be thinking about harm as being on a spectrum, right? It has effects on sharks. For some species, those seem like they can be pretty harmful. For others, maybe not. But you never want to say that the absence of knowledge means the absence of harm. And I would say most studies that I've read about this show across a wide variety of wildlife that they're changed by tourism. Whether or not that changes the problem depends on who you are and what you think a problem is. But those changes do occur. But one of the most important things is that people often kind of approach me with this silver bullet. Tourism is a panacea for conservation, right? Where, okay, we're going to turn fishermen into tourism operators. And to be perfectly honest, in a lot of places, that's not feasible. Tourists want somebody who's knowledgeable about what they're seeing. They expect certain standards of equipment and safety that a lot of fishers could not meet in many parts of the world. They expect language skills from their guide that many fishers do not have. And quite frankly, an awful lot of people I know became fishers because they don't like other people that much. And it's an excuse to spend all day, every day out on the water in solitude with your own thoughts. And so you may not be a person who's that keen to buckle up your life jacket and take two obnoxious American tourists out for a day of snorkeling.
Americans aren't the most friendly tourists you've ever dealt with? What are you talking about?
We can be absolutely delightful. Honestly, I just didn't want to drag any other country into it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Keyword can be.
Yeah. And one of the things I also would just want to touch base on and make sure that we at least acknowledge is that just because a marine reserve is small doesn't mean it's bad and doesn't mean it's not working for the intended purpose. One of the things that we brought up is that sometimes it doesn't always protect the shark species that we want because those shark species move outside of the marine reserve. However, there are many parts of the world where they're creating little patches of marine reserves that go in like a chain, which we call, I'm actually forgetting the term right now, but they create corridors basically between marine reserves so that a shark does have safety from point A to point B to point C to point D, where they might not be protected in between those areas, but once they get to those locations that are critical for where they feed or where they mate or where they're having all their pups, where they're giving birth, all of those might be protected, and that's where it can be very effective. And we actually have that off the California coast, where we have lots of marine reserves all down the California coast. So there's all these little patches where fish and all these different species can go and actually are protected, which creates a really great and effective system. But getting all of those marine reserves in place is very difficult.
You just reminded me of another point that I would be remiss not to make in this conversation, which is that when we talk about tourism as a silver bullet for sharks, we need to ask what sharks, because there are more than 500 species of sharks, and the number of those that people want to spend money to be in the water with are pretty small.
Like five. Yeah. It's like five of them.
Yeah. No, it's the shark. Name them.
Okay. There's great white shark, great hammerhead. I'm going to go with tiger shark.
Sand tigers.
Yeah, sand tigers. What else? Any sort of shark that hangs out on a reef, because people will be like, I want to go diving on a reef just to see the white tip reef sharks. That was all on one hand, plus like a pinky finger on the other hand. But basically, it's really small in comparison to how many shark species there are.
And there are tons of shark species that live in cold water or in murky water or way far offshore, or deep, deep water, or sometimes all of those. I see your reaction. And we're never selling tickets. We're never selling tickets for those sharks, right? The average adult shark is like 3.5 feet long. And people are just not lining up for the pajama cat shark.
I don't know why. They're so cute. Why would you not want to see them in their natural habitat, obviously from a distance and not touching them and cradling them like you want to, but still.
Why wouldn't you want to look at their tail sticking out of a crevice?
Exactly.
200 yards away in cold, murky water. Yeah. I can't imagine.
It's so true.
So when people tell you that shark tourism is going to conserve sharks, you know, it's not that there's no truth to it, but it is worth interrogating, like, what sharks, where, and to the extent that it is going to make a difference for species that are actually threatened, how exactly, right? What is the mechanism by which you're going to be helping? Because in a lot of cases, those species that there's tourist demand for, and the species of shark that are critically endangered, there's very little overlap. Not zero, but not that much. So if tourism in and of itself is going to conserve them, you know, I'm not sure that I think angel shark tourism is going to solve angel shark conservation problems. So again, it's not that tourism isn't a tool. It's not that it doesn't have any value. But like any tool, you want to look at it and figure out what you can realistically use it for before you start trying to deploy it.
Yes, I think that is a great way to end the summary of this paper. Do you have anything else that we missed that you think we absolutely must say?
I'm sorry I brought the most chaotic end of the semester energy to this interview imaginable.
And what are you talking about?
And it's I did not stay on topic.
Oh no. Oh my goodness. These are all topics that we absolutely want to discuss. This is perfect. But we absolutely have to ask you now, do you have a field story? Because this is our absolute favorite part of the podcast.
Okay. So first of all, I want to say, if you, like me, are a person who was like, I don't get seasick, never been seasick.
Macho.
All I can tell you is, it's coming for you. No matter who you are, there is some combination of sea state, boat size, lack of sleep, your physical state that will put you over the edge and your cookies will be tossed. And I tell you that as somebody who in a 12-year fieldwork heavy career has been seasick just the one time. But this one time, we were heading offshore and I was not very experienced, right? It was probably my first or second year working in shark research. And we're headed offshore and, you know, you trust the captains to make decisions, especially when you're inexperienced. And he said we could go, so we went. But we literally found ourselves in a 19-foot boat in 21-foot seas, where like perfect storm style, we were like motoring up the waves and then like falling into the trough. And so I am like clinging to a pole in the center of this boat, just like trying not to get thrown off the boat. And I was like, I'm gonna die. It's probably the most I've ever thought I was gonna die doing field work.
That's terrifying.
So we get through these waves and out to where it's flatter, and we're several miles offshore and we're looking for blue sharks and makos that day. And we get out there and I'm done, right? Like I'm broken spiritually, physically, it's over. And everybody else is like, all right, let's start chumming. So they're chumming. And immediately there's blue sharks around the boat. They're just like circling the boat. And I'm like still trying to unlock my fingers from this pole. And finally it's like it's the culmination of being inside a martini shaker, right? And so finally it settles enough for it to hit me. And I just like bolt to the side of the boat and I toss my cookies directly onto the face of a blue shark that was just there, just, you know, doing blue shark stuff. And
this was not on my bingo card of 2020.
I felt so terrible, right? Because I was like new and, you know, I mean, at this point in my career, I've seen sharks do all kinds of crazy stuff. So I don't expect them to be fazed by human vomit. But at the time I was like, oh my God, shark, I'm so sorry. He did not care. He just went about his business. But I was so embarrassed. You know, it was my first time working with this crew and I was, you know, a newly fledged scientist and I wanted to impress them and I'd never been seasick in my life. I hadn't taken anything because of course I hadn't because I'd never been seasick in my life. And so I am here from your future as a cautionary tale to tell you that it does not matter if you don't think that you will get seasick. In the right situation, you will get seasick. And then you will feel guilty about blue sharks for the rest of your life.
One of the things that I remember so distinctly from one of the first times that I was out at field school is you said, if you haven't been seasick, it's because you haven't met the wave that's gonna make you seasick. And I say that to myself in my head every single time I consider if I'm going to take Dramamine on a boat.
Yeah.
You'll be way more useful if you're like a little tired than if you're puking your guts out.
Yes, 100%. And if you haven't been seasick, I have once before as well. You don't really recover from that for a long time until like hours after you're on land. You feel like you're moving, or I don't know about.
Oh, and the other thing that I should add is that I was one of those really obnoxious people who was like, it's just a wave. What's your deal, people who are throwing up right now? This is fine. And then I was seasick and I was like, let me die. Yeah. It was horrible. It's really bad.
It's really
so
bad.
If Karma. You don't get seasick, have sympathy for people who do get seasick because it is legit awful.
It's like vertigo for your body.
Yeah, I get really bad sea legs. I think that's the word where like when you walk on land, you feel like you're still moving. I have fallen over multiple times on land because I stop to stand still and my body's just like, no, we're going to this 45 degree angle, but the ground is not moving with you in that direction.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much, Dr. McDonald. That was the absolute best way to end this podcast. And for our Sharkies out there, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope to see you in a couple weeks for our next episode.
Swim you later.
That's how we're ending all of our podcasts.
You guys are so good.